Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hissan Habre, by Reed Brody, narrated by Reed Brody.
Dedication. For Hissan Habre's victims, for the memory of Michael Ratner, and for my son Zachary. Foreword by the Chadian lawyer Jacqueline Mudena. Recover their lost dignity. That was the aim of the battle Reed Brody and I fought for two decades. Give some dignity back to the thousands of victims of Hissan Habre's regime. Show our hatred of injustice. Show our hatred of servitude. I am an orphan. At 11 years old, I had no father or mother. I didn't have the same childhood as other children. I learned to fight alone. But even as a kid, I loathed injustice. The French political philosopher La Boétie wrote, "In a world governed by nature, which is reasonable, there is nothing so contrary as injustice." That's how I felt, too. Seeing someone fall victim to injustice filled me with deep sadness. I would always say, "It's not fair," as I walked to school with my friends. It was my favorite expression. Even when I was little, when something wasn't fair, I would go after whoever was responsible, alone. The others would watch me. I wanted to show them I could fight for myself. And I learned that through hatred of injustice, and with enough courage, you could move mountains. The atrocities carried out in Chad by Habre and his henchmen in the 1978-1979 Civil War, before he became president in 1982, drove me into exile in Brazzaville in the Congo Republic. Even though I was far from my country, I could see how many orphans the Habre regime was producing. Seeing children whose parents had died because of the megalomania of a brutal man left a very bitter taste in my mouth. I could easily put myself in their place. At the time, I was studying law, and I was determined to become a lawyer for the voiceless, to represent those who didn't even know they had rights. I thought of Aimé Césaire, who wrote, "My mouth shall be the mouth of voiceless misfortunes. My voice shall be the freedom of those who break down in the dungeon of despair." As soon as Habre fell from power in 1990, I started imagining his trial, and imagining, too, that I would be part of it. At the time, I believed that the Chadian government would prosecute him, but I soon understood that would never happen. Seeing all those victims, those widows, those orphans from the Habre years brought back the same rage, the same anger at the injustice I had felt when I was little. The Pinochet case encouraged us. It was possible to prosecute a former head of state, but you don't take on a dictator alone. In Reed, I found a brother, a comrade in arms. We were so different. He was fighting for human dignity, fighting to put powerful people behind bars. I was fighting for my people, for my continent. He was thinking about the world and about humanity. I was thinking about my brothers, my sisters, my compatriots. In a world without crime, we would not have met. In a world without human rights activism, we would not have gotten to know each other. What brought us together were the torture, the massacres, the mass graves, the hardship and suffering and stress of the Chadian people. A Chadian lawyer and an American lawyer. Everything separated us, but we joined forces to defend universal values, and we won. Despite our huge differences and repeated failures, despite our numerous arguments, despite his atheism and my Christianity, we restored some honor to people who had no voice, to people who had no freedom. Together, we shared the burden of the campaign for the fair trial of Hissin Habre. As Frantz Fanon wrote, "We are nothing on earth if we are not first and foremost slaves to a cause of peoples, the cause of justice and liberty." But it was so long, it was so difficult, it was so dangerous. I met Reed for the first time in Dakar in May 2000. We had just filed a case against Habre, accusing him of torture and crimes against humanity. We had taken the crazy gamble of petitioning the Senegalese courts under the UN Convention Against Torture. I was young then, and Reed didn't believe I'd be up to the task. But the fact that he thought this and said it to some of our friends only made me more determined to forge ahead, to keep working, to keep learning. In time, Reed came around and supported me at every turn. He paid attention whenever I ran into difficulties or felt unsure of myself. He always tried to help. He always thought of me and supported me. The affection and solidarity he showed me over the years have a lasting place in my heart. In the end, we shared the same all-consuming obsession to convict Hissin Habre, to convict him in a fair and equitable way, for Chad, for Africa, for the world. We wanted to show that dictators can't always hide and get away with their crimes. We wanted to send an unmistakable signal to other tyrants who crush their people that they can't use geopolitical struggles like the war against terrorism as an excuse to flout human rights and fundamental values. It was Reed who set the pace. His hard work and obsessive attention to detail pushed us all to do better. Many times he'd disregard the time difference across continents and wake me to discuss some new idea and solicit my thoughts. He didn't look at the clock. The way he saw it, we just had to keep going. We had to succeed. For him, there was no, oh well, no never mind. We often got cross with each other. I rebuked him for not listening to others enough, for only listening to himself. Over the years, he got better at listening to me, at moving in my direction too. It was a long struggle. For 14 years, all of us, survivors, victims, orphans, and yes, lawyers too, suffered as Habre continued to go unpunished. Politicians and diplomats wanted nothing to do with this hot potato, as Senegalese journalists called the case. But we carried on regardless, mobilizing victims in Chad and investigating and documenting the crimes to keep up the pressure. We became a thorn in the side of those who wanted to politicize our fight for the rule of law and justice. In Senegal, Hissin Habre had set up a powerful network of people who protected him. They wanted to paint him not as a criminal despot, responsible for the horrific deaths of their Chadian brothers and sisters, but as the savior of Africa. We were fighting for the memory of those who perished. We were lawyers from beyond the grave, shaking the foundations of the temple of the powerful. In every great fight against impunity, in every campaign for justice and transparency, as soon as you get close to the heart of the thugocracy, nothing is off limits. Friends switch sides, and disinformation becomes a new form of communication. And so, even after we began to win our fight, after a new Senegalese president announced in 2012 that he would organize a trial, and the African Union created a special court to hear the case, we had to redouble our efforts. It was our responsibility to make sure that the trial was exemplary, that the evidence was strong, that the victims and their lawyers showed dignity. We had to set aside our exhaustion and our clashing egos and form a common front to face the extraordinary pressures of the moment. We knew the other side would play dirty, and they did. Habre chose vulgarity over dignity, preferring to defy the judges in court rather than to accept their authority. Plainly, the former warlord still thought he was above the law. For the victims, though, the trial was a moment of glory. Finally, they were being taken seriously. We succeeded in showing the world the true terror of Hissin Habre's regime. In minute detail, we revealed the inner workings of a repressive machine set up and controlled by the former tyrant. Rarely has there been an international criminal case as convincing as the one we had presented, or as shocking. I would like to pay particular tribute to the women who testified about the rapes and other terrible acts of sexual aggression that they endured at the hands of Habre and his police and military. They dared break a taboo in front of the former dictator, in front of the world, under the glaring lights of an international court. The truth that they spoke has had widespread repercussions, emboldening young women and their families in Chad to bring rape cases for the first time. Their example encapsulates the importance of the fight against impunity. It's a way of breaking the vicious cycles of corruption and human rights violations that grow worse the more they go unpunished. In countries like Chad, impunity has become ingrained in government practice, a way for one clan to assert its domination over the rest of the population. Impunity sets up hierarchies, dividing people into two distinct castes, those who steal the country's resources and grant themselves the right of life and death, and their victims. My objective, my dream, is to achieve zero impunity in Chad. It is the stone I want to lay in the construction of my country's development. We succeeded with our former dictator, but there is still so much to do. My wish is that our work inspire future generations of lawyers and civil rights advocates, not just in Chad, but across Africa, where impunity is the source of most of the continent's problems. All my brothers and sisters talk about it. Even the African Union talks about it. But most African leaders treat these conversations as empty words. They take no concrete actions. It is up to us, the civil society activists, to make a difference. It's a difficult, dangerous, and painful task. You can't know how great the obstacles are until it becomes your daily struggle. You have to have broad shoulders. For us, the Habre case is a source of huge pride, the first milestone in a much broader fight. The precedent it has set is now inspiring victims of abominable crimes in places like the Gambia, the Central African Republic, and Côte d'Ivoire. For those who want to embrace our cause, I say, listen to this book. Listen to it like a manual, like a set of instructions. Learn from our mistakes and our successes. Listen to the words of Reed Brody to the end, because without him, there would have been no Habre trial. We won because we had this man by our side. I always tell survivors, widows, and orphans, if Reed hadn't taken on this case, the person responsible for all your suffering would not have been put behind bars. If Reed had abandoned us, as others did, we wouldn't have obtained justice. So, Reed, thank you, and thank you on behalf of the victims, too. I give thanks and glory to God, my Father, and Jesus, who made this struggle possible and crowned it with success. Prologue. For 16 years, I dreamed of this moment. One of the world's most pitiless dictators, a man who had slaughtered his own people to seize and maintain power, who had burned down entire villages and built clandestine dungeons to inflict medieval torture on his enemies, was at last where he belonged, in the dock of an international criminal tribunal. I'd never caught more than a glimpse of him in the flesh. This man who had consumed my every waking hour for longer than I cared to remember. But now, Hissan Habre, the butcher of Chad, was sitting just a few feet away from me in a Senegalese courtroom. His authority gone, the all-consuming fear he once inspired, now just a haunting memory. For the past quarter century, Habre had enjoyed a comfortable exile just a few miles from where we were sitting, with villas and servants and dazzling views of the Atlantic Ocean. I had made it my mission to separate him from these comforts and ensure that he faced both justice and the accusatory gaze of his victims. I had spent years assembling an international team of investigators and lawyers. I had trained survivors to be campaigners, gathered evidence, chased down witnesses, raised millions of dollars in funding, even helped think up the statutes of the court now hearing his case. Over the years, I had walked on dusty earth, covering the mass graves of hundreds of Habre's victims. I had stumbled upon rooms where the files of Habre's secret police had been left strewn ankle deep. Along with a number of Habre's most committed victims and their lawyers, I had worked across continents to win over presidents and ministers, civic leaders and editorial writers. And now, thanks to all those years of work, we had Habre exactly where we wanted him. As press photographers swarmed Habre, I moved from my seat to get a better look. Along with his trademark flowing white boo-boo, he was dressed in a desert turban that concealed his mouth and the lower half of his nose, as if to tell us that the very air in the courtroom was toxic to him. Habre's dark eyes, framed by gold-rimmed glasses, caught mine for an instant before darting away. He knew exactly who I was, even if we'd never met. I was his relentless hunter, always popping up on television with his victims to remind the world of what he'd done. Reed Bloody, as one of his wives liked to call me, the man who wouldn't give up, the man who somehow bounced back each time his lawyers convinced themselves that they'd killed off the case once and for all. Down the years, Habre and his entourage had sought to paint me as an agent of imperialism and neocolonialism, an unscrupulous money-grubbing American Jew, armed and sponsored by the anti-Islam lobby, an enemy, as Habre had handwritten to the tribunal, who has never hidden his aggressive and outrageous hostility, a specialist in forgery and lies. But it was not just me he was facing. In a few minutes, the judges of this extraordinary Pan-African tribunal would enter in their fine robes of ruby-red silk, bordered with white fur and black spots. Behind them stood the full weight not only of their Senegalese government hosts, but of the African Union and the broader international community. The victims in the courtroom and the principal lawyers representing them were very far from neocolonialists, as Habre well knew. Although Habre tried to paint them as my puppets and mascots, they were his fellow Chadians, men and women who had survived torture and rape to demand justice. They had dreamed of this day even more ardently than I had. One thing we knew coming in was that Habre would not be going down quietly. From his formative years as a guerrilla commander in Chad's northern desert, he had an instinctive understanding of asymmetric warfare, of the importance of seizing every advantage when the odds were stacked against him. Even before the judges swept in to occupy their seats, dozens of his supporters burst into the courtroom, chanting slogans. And Habre stood up and shouted right along with them. "Aba l'imperialisme," they yelled, and he responded, "Down with imperialism." It was a rich line coming from a man who owed his ascent to power to the CIA, but the irony was largely lost in the passions of the moment. Police flooded into the courtroom, seeking to prevent the protesters from crowding in too close to Habre or clashing with his victims. black-clad elite Senegalese guards sought in vain to coax the former dictator back into his seat, but he kept pushing and jostling until at length they grabbed him by the arms and dragged him out. "This is a farce! This is a farce!" he yelled, his right hand brandishing a string of gri-gri beads used to ward off evil spirits as he disappeared from sight, followed quickly by his lawyers. The trial hadn't even started, and already it was veering wildly off the rails. Working on the Habre case for Human Rights Watch, I was keenly aware of the contradictions of being an American lawyer seeking to prosecute an American-backed dictator, and I was not entirely surprised that Habre made this a principal line of attack. I've operated in the developing world for most of my life, and I've always tried to confound what my friend Macau Mutua calls the savages, victims, and saviors construct, in which white activists rescue black victims from black perpetrators. It's a construct that leaves no room for looking at the responsibility of Western actors and denies the agency of black victims. For 16 years, I never talked about Habre's crimes without emphasizing my own government's support of Habre under President Ronald Reagan. And I was painfully familiar with the glaring double standards in international justice that make it possible, but still very difficult, to bring to book third world despots, but not the leaders of more powerful countries. While I was working on the Habre case, I wrote 4 reports for Human Rights Watch on abuses that the George W. Bush administration had committed against Muslim detainees in the global war on terror. I wrote a book arguing that Bush and other top U.S. officials should be investigated for torture and war crimes. I even joined an effort in Europe, unsuccessful, of course, to pursue such an investigation through the same institutions of international justice I was championing in the Habre case. For some of my African critics, this was not enough. They'd ask what I was doing on their continent when I should be investigating the Bush administration's treatment of detainees at Guantanamo instead. And while this was plainly an argument of convenience and a bit of a cheap shot, it was not an entirely unfair critique of the international system. The fact was, I was a professional at a major Western human rights organization with access to funding and the international media, collaborating with disempowered victims from one of the poorest countries in the world. And that meant that there was a power imbalance inherent in what we were doing. My African partners and I had to figure out ways to spread ownership of the campaign, especially after the press began to label me a dictator hunter and sometimes erase the invaluable work of everyone around me. Chad was their country, their history, their future. As an outsider, I needed to tread with humility and avoid reproducing a post-colonial hierarchy that could only undermine the goals we had set for ourselves. In the process, we learned that by focusing on the stories of the victims and giving them a leading role in the campaign, we could capture public imagination and support in a way that a dictator hunter narrative never could do. I certainly made my share of mistakes along the way, mostly as I shuffled between my different roles as strategist, fundraiser, press agent, counsel, and producer of the prosecution effort. I grappled with my tendency to want to control everything. As a former tournament chess player, I often imagined that I was sitting across a board from Habre, locked in a battle of wits that only one of us could win. The long game was in my bones, and it required discipline, patience, and, yes, a degree of control that others sometimes chafed against. The French lawyer Olivier Bercot, whom I hired to work directly with Habre's victims in Chad, observed early on that I would often think of my allies, the victims, their lawyers, fellow activists, like chess pieces to be moved strategically as I saw fit. But of course, my partners were free-thinking individuals deeply invested in the case in their own right. not objects of my will. And checkmating Habre was not our only goal. Our campaign needed to be exemplary. We needed to make sure that any trial was both fair and seen to be fair. We needed the victims to receive the recognition and compensation they deserved. We weren't about to cut deals or make dirty compromises with the abusive Chadian government that had replaced Habre, or with anyone else, just to come away with something we could call a win. For me, the Habre case was the culmination of an activist life whose roots went all the way back to childhood. My mother was an urban public school arts teacher who inspired students from the toughest of backgrounds to win prizes year after year. She crossed picket lines, risking the ire of her fellow teachers to support the Black community's control of her school, and she took me to civil rights demonstrations and peace marches. She also wallpapered my childhood room with maps, instilling me with a lifelong love of cartography and a curiosity for foreign places. My Hungarian Jewish father survived forced labor in German camps during World War II, eventually escaping to join the Soviet Red Army and participate in the liberation of Budapest, before emigrating penniless to the United States, where he became a beloved university literature professor. When I was 12, my little brother and I declared independence from parental tyranny and wrote a constitution for our new country, which we called Brodania, based on equal rights and a ban on trade with any country governed by a dictator or a king. At 15, I went door to door in our poor Brooklyn neighborhood to support progressive political candidates. I was a college leader in the anti-Vietnam War movement. As a young lawyer in 1984, I took a trip to Nicaragua to see the Sandinista Revolution up close. There, in a mountain village near the Honduran border, where I knew the American priest, Catholic lay workers told me stories of schools and farmhouses being burned and of teachers and nurses being killed by the Contras, counter-revolutionaries organized by the United States, my country. Never before had I felt such a great responsibility to do something. I quit my job at the New York State Attorney General's office and went back to Nicaragua, where I spent 5 months traveling the war zones and asking people for their stories. I met widows whose husbands had been killed before their eyes, women who had been raped, people whose houses had been burned down. Just as I returned to the United States, President Reagan described the Contras as the moral equivalent of our founding fathers and asked Congress to increase military aid to help them. My report detailing their atrocities landed on the front page of the New York Times and earned me a personal rebuke from the president, who called me, quote, a sympathizer shepherded through Nicaragua by Sandinista operatives. Still, the report had the desired effect, concentrating enough minds in a divided Congress to deny Reagan the funding he sought. At age 31, I had helped defeat a U.S. president's foreign policy, and the experience filled me with a lifelong confidence that if I worked hard enough, I could make a difference anywhere in the world. That confidence was tested many times over the years as I tried, and mostly failed, to uncover atrocities or prosecute the perpetrators in places like Haiti, El Salvador, East Timor, Tibet, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. My father once compared me to the plague-fighting Dr. Bernard Rieu of his hero Albert Camus. I often felt more like Camus' Sisyphus, however, eternally pushing the rock up the hill, only to have it roll back down, but happy with the struggle itself towards the heights. My long pursuit of Hissin Habre would test me more strenuously still. Over and over, during my first 13 years working with the victims on the Habre case, when every step forward seemed to be followed by two steps back. I was told I had to be either naive or crazy.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?